Welcome to the Government Contracts Legal Roundup, a podcast focusing on important developments facing government contractors and grant recipients. This podcast is put on by the Jenner and Block Government Contracts Practice Group. I'm your host, David Robbins, and as my kids like to tell me, buckle up, buttercup, we got a lot to cover today. Let's start with claims. Aview Technologies Corp. versus Health and Human Services out of the Federal Circuit. March 6th is the decision date. This is when the Federal Circuit issued its much-anticipated decision in a case that presented the question of whether a company that indirectly licenses software to federal agencies through a reseller can bring a Contract Disputes Act claim to enforce alleged violations of the license terms. The Civilian Board of Contract Appeals had dismissed Aview's appeal for lack of jurisdiction after finding that the subject matter subscription agreement by itself did not constitute a procurement contract under the Contract Disputes Act because it was not a contract for the acquisition of property or services. The Federal Circuit vacated and remanded the CBCA decision for further proceedings on the merits. The Federal Circuit did not answer the most interesting question on appeal, and that is whether Aview actually has a procurement contract with the government that can be enforced under the CDA. Instead, the Federal Circuit held only that Aview had plausibly alleged that it is a party to a federal procurement contract and therefore met the baseline standard for invoking the board's jurisdiction. On remand, the parties will need to engage in further merits proceedings to determine if a procurement contract exists. This case may eventually answer the question of whether the CDA provides a viable means to enforce license terms that are passed to the government through a reseller. In the meantime, software companies, resellers, and agencies should all be mindful of the complex and uncertain jurisdictional framework that can apply to licensing disputes under government contracts. Moving on to Williams Building Company, a civilian board case, March 8th, decision day. Williams Building Company, or WBC, was awarded a fixed-price contract by the State Department's Office of Overseas Building Operations for construction services at the U.S. Consulate Lease Fit-Out in Wuhan, China. State Department terminated WBC's contract for convenience in the wake of COVID-19, and WBC accordingly submitted its total cost termination settlement proposal seeking its allowable costs, which was later converted into a claim. State Department denied WBC's claim, and WBC appealed to the Civilian Board. On appeal, the board rejected the argument that because WBC allegedly falsely certified that it had paid its subcontractors when it did not actually do so, WBC's prior breach of contract barred recovery of all of WBC's termination costs. The Civilian Board explained that since the State Department terminated the contract for convenience rather than default, a prior material breach by the contractor did not impact its claim for termination costs. At the same time, however, the factual allegations that WBC did not pay its subcontractors were nonetheless relevant because WBC bears the burden of establishing the costs that it incurred in performing its contract. Thus, the Civilian Board rejected WBC's argument that the board did not have jurisdiction to address whether the company had paid its subcontractors because doing so would require the board to make findings on fraud contrary to the Contract Disputes Act. The Civilian Board concluded that there was no need for it to make findings about fraud, only about WBC's ability to establish what costs it incurred during contract performance, including whether it paid its subcontractors. Now, this case is a fun one for those of us who work in the fraud arena, but it also serves as a reminder that if an agency terminates a contract for convenience, the subcontractor's prior material breaches of a contract do not, wholesale anyway, prohibit recovery of a contractor's claim, as it may in a termination for default. But it may still be relevant to the contractor's burden of proving the costs claimed. Let's move out of claims land and into bid protests. Let's talk about Expression Networks LLC, B number 422373, and a published decision March 13th. Here, GAO dismissed a protest challenging the award of a task order where the solicitation was issued to contractors holding an IDIQ contract valued at less than $25 million, but also referenced FAR subpart 8.4 procedures. The Department of Labor issued an RFQ to contractors holding the CHESS ITES-3 Services IDIQ contract. The RFQ referenced ordering procedures applicable to federal supply schedule contracts as set forth in FAR subpart 8.4. The agency awarded the $17.4 million task order in response to the post-award protest requested dismissal on the basis that GAO lacks jurisdiction over this task order procurement. GAO found that although the RFQ invoked FAR 8.4 procedures, that did not transform it into an FSS procurement or indicate that the Department of Labor would place the resultant order under an FSS contract. This was instead a task order competition strictly between firms holding the CHESS, ITESS 3S, IDIQ contract, which is a mouthful, but you know what I'm talking about, which could therefore only result in an issuance of a task order under that contract. GAO thus lacked jurisdiction over the protest. What does that tell us? Contractors must be cognizant of GAO's strict requirements when it will and will not hear a protest. GAO does not possess jurisdiction in connection with the issuance of a task order, except where the task order increases the scope, period, or maximum value of the contract under which the order is issued, or where the task order is valued in excess of the jurisdictional thresholds, $25 million under Title 10 or $10 million under Title 41. Okay, another fun one. DGCI Corp. B422188.3 and 4, March 5th, that's the decision date. Here, GAO dismissed a protest where the protester was unable to demonstrate it would have a substantial chance at award, even if it succeeded in its challenge to the awardee's quotation. Here, DLA, the Defense Logistics Agency, conducted a procurement for jet fuel under FAR subpart 12.6, where the award would be made to the low-priced, technically acceptable offeror. DGC argued that DLA's award was improper because it unreasonably evaluated the awardee's technical proposal, which DGCI contended was unacceptable. DGCI also argued that two other vendors who were lower priced than the company submitted unacceptable proposals because they must have contained fraudulent certifications regarding the source of fuel. In response, DLA contended that its evaluation of all three vendors' proposals was reasonable, consistent with the solicitation, which did not require a vendor's certification to be from a specific source. In its comments, DGCI altered its arguments with respect to the two other vendors, contending that they must have otherwise been fraudulent given their similarities. Following an investigation by the CO, DLA determined that the certifications were not submitted fraudulently and confirmed that at least one of the other vendors' proposals was technically acceptable. So after reviewing the rationale supplied by the other two vendors, GAO concluded that the vendors' explanations regarding their certification similarities were plausible and that DLA's conclusion regarding the acceptability of one of the proposals was reasonable. Accordingly, GAO dismissed the protest because DGCI could not have been an interested party under the terms of the solicitation. There's a lot there, but the decision reinforces GAO's strict adherence to the interested party requirements for protests. Contractors are encouraged to consult with counsel to ensure they have adequate standing to protest before filing and wasting all that time and all that money. Let's move on to a False Claims Act update as we come down the home stretch. In U.S. XREL Hunter v. Fillmore Capital Partners, LLC, a relator alleged that the defendants have violated the False Claims Act by billing Medicare and Medicaid for substandard medical care at 273 nursing homes. A defendant may violate the FCA when they seek reimbursement for a worthless service, which is defined as a service that is so deficient that for all practical purposes, it is equivalent of no performance at all. Here, the relator alleged that defendants understaffed their facilities to a degree that it would have been impossible to provide adequate care. Defendants filed a motion to dismiss, and the Eastern District of Pennsylvania granted it, noting that the relator failed to plead the alleged FCA violation with particularity, as required by Rule 9b. While the relator claimed the defendants' facilities were understaffed, the relator never provided factual details that would support the submission of false claims as a result of that understaffing. The court noted that relator's claims were doomed by the lack of facts. Additionally, the relator's allegations of worthless services were conclusory, did not specify when, where, or how the worthless services occurred. Look, I litigate in the False Claims Act arena a lot, and these imprecise complaints we see a lot of. So these motions to dismiss will just continue to take on added importance in the False Claims Act practice, especially as more and more cases continue on even after government declination. But also for contractors, another of the key takeaways from this case is that the court's distinction between worthless services and diminished services, that's worth knowing. A worthless services claim must assert that the care was so substandard as to amount to no services at all, whereas a deficient or diminished services, they just don't have to satisfy that standard. And it's important to remember that a worthless services claim cannot proceed if some services have been provided. You just can't establish the elements. All right, that was a lot. I need a drink of water. You all need a break. Probably some of you need a nap, because this is Government Contracts, and I know it's exciting for some of us, but not everybody. So I'll just thank you for joining us for the Government Contracts Legal Roundup. And if you have any questions or need more information about anything here, I can be reached at 202-639-6040 or drobbins@jenner.com. Thank you so much.